This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here we enlighten you with ayahs 36 through 38 from the Surah Nahl, recited by Qasim Razi.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم ولقد بعثنا في كل أمة رسولا أن اعبدوا الله واجتنبوا الطاغوت فمنهم من هدى الله ومنهم من حقت عليه الضلالة فسيروا في الأرض فانظروا كيف كان عاقبة المكذبين إن تحرص على هداهم فإن الله لا يهدي من يضل وما لهم من ناصرين وأقسموا بالله جهد أيمانهم لا يبعث الله من يموت بلى وعدا عليه حقا ولكن أكثر الناس لا يعلمون بلى وعدا عليه حقا ولكن أكثر الناس لا يعلمون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. And certainly we raised in every nation an apostle, saying, Serve Allah and shun the Satan. So there were some of them who Allah guided, and there were others against whom error was due. Therefore travel in the land, then see what was the end of the rejecters. If you desire further guidance, yet surely Allah does not guide him who leads astray, nor shall they have any helpers. And they swear by Allah with the most energetic of their oath, Allah will not raise up him who dies. Yeah, is a promise binding on him quite true, but most people do not know.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines. Iran is observing a national day of mourning after Wednesday's terror attack in the southern city of Kerman. It killed nearly 100 people. Iranian officials vow a strong response to perpetrators and masterminds of the terror bombings in Kerman amid global condemnations of the attack. And the death toll from Israeli genocide in Gaza exceeds 22,300 as refugee camps and healthcare sectors remain the main targets of the regime's strikes. Our top story for this half hour, Iran is observing a national day of mourning after Wednesday's deadly terror attacks targeting civilians in the southern city of Kerman. Twin blasts killed 84 Iranians and injured over 200 others at a ceremony marking the fourth assassination anniversary of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. According to the Interior Minister, the two explosions occurred minutes apart at two different locations crowded with people. Ahmad Vahidi said the bombs contained shrapnel that caused the extreme amount of casualties. Hours after the attack, the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution vowed a strong response to both perpetrators and masterminds of the terror bombings. In a message, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said the callous criminals could not tolerate the people's love and enthusiasm for visiting the resting place of their great commander, martyred Soleimani. President Ibrahim Raisi has also vowed that the perpetrators will pay a heavy price for this horrible crime.
این These gatherings that you see held in the country, this flood of people that pour towards the grave of Haj Qasem these days, you come to scare the people within your criminal act. You're not strong enough to face the resistance. Your power has lost its effectiveness against the forces of resistance. Now you're targeting innocent people? Know that you will pay a heavy price for this horrible crime.
The Iranian president was addressing a ceremony marking the assassination anniversary of General Soleimani. Raisi also talked to Emir of Qatar Sheikh Tamim bin Hamad Al Thani. On the phone, he said Zionists who are facing global condemnations over their ruthless massacre of Palestinians are now trying to spread insecurity to other parts of the region. Strong condemnations are pouring in from world's political leaders over the deadly terrorist bombings that targeted Iranian civilians in the southeastern city of Kerman. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres vehemently condemned the blast, which left hundreds of people dead and wounded. Russian President Vladimir Putin also slammed what he called terrorism in all its forms, condemning the blast. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said Turkey stands by Iran in the fight against terrorism. The European Union also blasted the bombings as an act of terror, stressing that perpetrators must be held accountable. Iraq's top Shia cleric, Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, decried the killing of innocent people in Iran while condoling with the families of the victims. Yemen's Ansar al-Labuban said the explosions were carried out due to Iran's crucial role in supporting the resistance front in Palestine and Lebanon. Palestinian resistance movements Hamas and Islamic Jihad have also condemned the terror attacks. Saudi Foreign Ministry slammed the terrorist operation against civilians in Iran. We earlier talked to author and journalist Robert Fantina to get his views about Wednesday terror bombings in Iran. He believes that despite their denials, the U.S. and Israel are behind such attacks. Let's take a listen.
Whoever is behind it, and I think we can assume who that is, that this has the United States and Israel written all over it. They have no regard for human life. They have demonstrated that repeatedly. They're currently demonstrating it in the genocide that is ongoing in Gaza right now. But the fact that they have used this time, the occasion when the people of Iran are remembering General Soleimani, remembering his heroism, his loyalty to the country and his patriotism, and to target innocent people, innocent men, women, and children, who are there simply to mourn and to remember and to honor a hero who was assassinated 4 years ago. This is barbaric. This is savagery that we see from the United States and Israel on a regular basis. Neither country has claimed responsibility yet, and perhaps they won't. But whoever eventually claims responsibility for this, it is likely that the source will be one of those two countries.
Iraqis have joined millions of people all across the globe to pay tribute to revered martyrs General Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. We have a report on that.
Thousands of Iraqi people have gathered at Baghdad International Airport to honor revered martyrs General Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, who were assassinated by the United States in a drone attack near the airport back in 2020.
These people have gathered today to condemn the U.S. crime and show their will to continue our leader's path in fighting against the Israeli oppression.
We came today to commemorate and pay respect to those who gave all they had to protect this land.
Among the people were prominent figures such as Chief of Popular Mobilization Units Faleh Al-Fayyad, who stressed that Iraqis will forever hold in memory their revered leaders of the resistance and will raise generations based on their noble values.
General Soleimani was a unique man. He was a nation in a man and a symbol of bravery, principle, and manners. He held the dignity of the nation and exemplified it throughout the region through his actions rather than mere words.
Al-Fayyad also mentioned that General Soleimani and Abu Mahdi were prepared for martyrdom at every minute and every moment. He also highlighted that such gatherings symbolize loyalty to those who sacrificed their lives and their blood. The gathering was accompanied by chants demanding revenge for the martyrs. and asserting that justice must be served upon those responsible for the cowardly assassination. The attendees also condemned the U.S. policies towards Iraq. They denounced Washington for violating Iraq's sovereignty and also for attempts at targeting anti-terrorism forces in the region.
The U.S. tries to target Iraq's resistance factions in an effort to destabilize the country's political system and stability.
Today marks 4 years since the U.S. assassination of General Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mehdi al-Muhandis. Huge crowds have gathered here today at Baghdad Airport to pay homage and respect for the revered leaders. This amid rising demands for an immediate cessation of U.S. military presence on Iraqi soil. Muslim Salim, Baghdad.
January the 3rd marks the fourth anniversary of the assassination of late Iranian anti-terror commander Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Our correspondent in Islamabad, Nasir Kazmi, has talked to people about the role the late general played in the region. Let's take a listen.
He was fighting the Western hegemony and Western aggression in Middle East and many Islamic countries. And that is the reason the Americans and who were against General Qasem Soleimani, because he was resisting their expansion.
A hero, a person who fought for his nation, a person who fought for the Islam, and a person who fought against all those powers like Israel, like USA, who is against Islam, and who are doing whatever they can do to minimize Islam and to link Islam toward terror.
Qasem Soleimani's killing was multidimensional, that so many countries and so many oppressors were getting benefit from this incident, and they still are. I don't see that his role has been replaced.
General Qasem Soleimani, he always had a great importance on West Asia and Palestine region in Syria and Lebanon and other surrounding areas. And it was because of him that the world was able to defeat Daesh.
He provided strategic, moral, political support to the people of Palestine. I think on his anniversary, which is being observed, late General Qasem Soleimani was a symbol of peace, was symbol of resistance. He was symbol to crush the terrorism.
The U.S.-Israeli genocide in Gaza continues unabated as the regime keeps pounding the blockaded territory, especially the healthcare sector, with airstrikes and artillery fire. The Palestinian Red Crescent Society says Israeli forces bombed its headquarters in Khan Yunis. They also shelled several houses and sites in and around the Al-Amal Hospital. The Red Crescent's transmission tower has also been targeted, hampering the work of its ambulance crews. At least 5 people were killed and several others injured in those attacks. In Rafah, at least 3 civilians were killed in an airstrike. Airstrikes also targeted Palestinian homes in central Gaza, killing dozens of people and injuring many others. The air raids hit the vicinity of a junior high school in Al Buraij refugee camp, wounding dozens of displaced people. A girls' high school, agricultural land, and a clinic were also hit by the regime's intense bombardment of Al Maghazi refugee camp in central Gaza. More than 22,300 people have been killed in the U.S.-Israeli genocide in Gaza so far. Well, joining us now from Deir al-Bala in central Gaza is our correspondent, Moti Abu Mustabe, with all the latest updates from on the ground in the Gaza Strip. Moti, what do you have to share with us in the aftermath of the incessant Israeli bombing and shelling that has continued today?
Yes, in fact, today is the 90th consecutive day of this continuous genocidal war waged on Gaza Strip. And actually, the Israeli airstrikes and the Israeli bombardments are still continued, leaving more Palestinian casualties from the civilian Palestinians here in the central area of Gaza Strip. Talking about the latest developments on the ground, the Israeli occupation forces attempted to raid more parts of the central area of Gaza City of the Gaza Strip. particularly Al-Maghazi refugee camp, which is the closest part and the closest refugee camp to Deir el-Balah city, where we are standing right now. And this kind of these attempts actually was happening and taking place amid fierce bombardments and shelling launched by the Israeli tanks on the ground, and fierce and vehement gunfights erupted between the Palestinian resistance groups and members and the Israeli occupation forces on the ground in a way to deter the Israeli occupation and to prevent the Israeli occupation from moving towards those parts. And let me say that this kind of the continuous bombardment and the continuous chilling of the Israeli occupation forces towards the Palestinian residential areas in the central area of Gaza Strip actually raised the concerns among the people here in the central area, particularly the Palestinian families who take shelter in the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital, that the Israeli occupation forces would attack the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital. Therefore, dozens of the Palestinian families moved to the south and evacuated from the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital into Rafah City. So we are talking about chaotic situation right now taking place. We are talking about rising concerns among those people. And as we speak right now, the sounds of the explosions and the bombardments unleashed by the Israeli occupation forces are being heard as we speak right now. Multiple Palestinian casualties were brought to the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital. And actually, as we speak right now, as you can see behind me, here is the ambulances bringing Palestinian, more Palestinian casualties resulted in from the continuous Israeli airstrikes. And the people, as you can see, that the vicinity of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital is overcrowded with the people. The vast majority of those people are from the Palestinian families who are being attacked in the central area of Gaza Strip. As we can see here, are some people here who are totally bereaved, who are totally burst into tears, bidding farewell to their beloved ones and to their relatives who were killed and slaughtered by the Israeli continuous shelling and the Israeli continuous airstrikes. And let me say that it's worth mentioning that over the last night, the Israeli occupation, the Israeli warplanes targeted several residential buildings in the central area of Gaza Strip, particularly Deir el-Balah city, where at least 10 Palestinian civilians were massacred over those airstrikes. In Khan Yunis city as well, at least 14 Palestinian civilians were also killed over the continuous Israeli bombardments, bounding the Palestinian residential buildings and houses. The vast majority of those dead bodies are from children and women. And so these are the targets of the Israeli occupation forces. We are talking about continuous, brutal Israeli aggression still taking place here and waged on the Palestinian civilians in Gaza Strip.
All right, thanks a lot, Moti, for the update. Moti Abu Musabe joining us from Deir el-Balah in central Gaza. Moving on, the United Nations top court is to hear submissions next week from South Africa and Israel after Pretoria opened a case for the Zionist regime's genocidal acts in Gaza. South Africa has asked the International Court of Justice to urgently order Israel to stop its onslaught on Gaza. The South African application filed last Friday is related to the regime's violations of its obligations under the Genocide Convention. Israel has rejected the case. South Africa will present its arguments next Thursday, while Israel is set to counter Pretoria's case on Friday. The ICJ is expected to hand down its ruling on the request for emergency measures within weeks. The court's decisions are legally binding, but it has little power to enforce them. The UN's Maritime Agency says some of the world's largest shipping companies keep avoiding the Red Sea amid an increase in assaults on Israeli-linked vessels in the strategic waterway. The head of the International Maritime Organization says 18 shipping firms have already decided to reroute their vessels around South Africa to reach their destinations. Arsenio Dominguez says the move represents an additional 10 days to the journey and negative impact on trade with increasing freight rates. The Yemeni armed forces have been targeting Israeli and Israeli-bound commercial ships in the Red Sea in support of Palestinians in Gaza. They've already announced that all vessels except Israel-bound can safely sail through the Red Sea and the Suez Canal. The Yemeni army has also defied U.S. threats, saying that its stance won't change until Israel ends its deadly aggression against Palestinians. That's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
When the whole world is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday five things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
in the limelight.
The Al-Aqsa storm operation, also known as Al-Aqsa flood, has done more than cement the new equation in Palestine. It is actively contributing to shaping the region's new face in a multipolar world. It is symbolic of the declining influence of the United States in the West Asia region. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for the third part, please. Press TV wrote, the United States knew long before the Hamas-led Palestinian resistance launched the Al-Aqsa Storm that its attempts to destabilize key members of the Axis of Resistance to keep its monopoly over the region had ultimately failed. Through multiple changes across the region, which succeeded in accelerating a new multipolar world. This includes the failing propaganda culture war against Iran, the failed destabilization of Syria, the unfolding of BRICS, new strategic alliances such as those between China, Iran, Saudi Arabia, and China, Syria, and the potential creation of a new rival economic corridor that would facilitate a shift away from the traditional U.S. monopoly over this area to Russia and China. Many U.S. plans directly backfired, including the economic warfare on Iran that managed to turn the issue of sanctions into an opportunity, and both Daesh and Israeli campaigns against the Lebanese resistance, which helped them expand field capabilities and experience. The events of October 7th are a necessary continuation of this process, as this multipolar world cannot flourish with the existence of an entity whose sole function is to act as an outpost for Western interests in the region. Al-Aqsa Storm is directly challenging the U.S. hegemony, as with the emergence of a strong resistance after this confrontation, the U.S. will have no choice but to take the resistance as a force that is here to stay and one that needs to be handled with an air of compromise. New deals between Saudi Arabia and Iran can be seen in light of the U.S. tending towards the direction of compromise to ensure some stake in the region, as the axis of resistance becomes a more permanent feature of it. The Israeli entity is therefore becoming more than just a liability. It is becoming an impediment to the new phase of a strategic compromise that the United States is currently moving towards. The Axis of Resistance has proved that it has the upper hand in this battle, and at a broader level, that the occupation is not fit to withstand shifts in the region towards a multipolar world. Amid the latest aggression on Gaza alone, it has been unable to secure its interests both in Gaza and across the Northern Front, and has to consistently work towards the resistance demands, which was most potently seen in the terms of the temporary humanitarian truce, where the entity went from demanding the full eradication of the Palestinian armed resistance to simply an exchange of Israeli non-combatant women and children for Palestinians held in the Zionist regime's prisons. By extension, the U.S. regime has had to confront the harsh reality of another failed cause. As the occupation's functional role as an outpost of Western influence in the region has become increasingly outdated, failing to withstand the test of time. A new multipolar world cannot exist with markers of the old. the Zionist entity, being the most tangible one, has found itself struggling to maintain its position under the weight of these shifts. To see the Zionist entity as the only enemy is to miss the broader picture. U.S. influence, which has typically dominated the region, is the driving force behind the entity. If the U.S. ceases its military and financial backing, the Israeli occupation can no more function. As such, effective assistance of the Palestinian resistance would require the targeting of the primary enemy, which is the occupation's master. This is what the Axis excels in. The Zionist entity went from being a strong and dependable military base for the U.S. to now acting as a regional reserve force for the West, to use as ant when it seeks to stoke up tension in the region. Yet, as these shifts continue to cement out a Western favor, the entity's functional role is losing importance. Despite attempts to paint the axis of resistance as subservient to Iran, the different approaches of each member have borne fruit in this struggle against occupation and domination. The Lebanese resistance has approached from a measured and a strategic position to wear out the entity by targeting its military bases, security systems, and any threats on Levantine soil. Concurrently, the Iraqi and Syrian resistance have played supportive roles by directing their efforts against U.S. bases, which constitutes a direct challenge to U.S. presence in the region. Meanwhile, Ansarullah has acted as the arms of the resistance, dealing significant blows directly to the entity's ability to engage in international trade and function normally in regional waters as a legitimate state by halting Israeli ships in the Red Sea, armed with weapons to continue its war crimes in Gaza. Before Al-Aqsa storm, the capabilities of the latter three members of the Axis were greatly underestimated based on this assumption rather than being seen as having their own strategic interest and methods of functioning. What Western commentators have struggled to understand is that despite their different methods, they are all ultimately aligned and motivated by one goal, which is to see an end to U.S. presence and influence in the region. The resistance operations right now against the Zionist entity, which is a key manifestation of that, is simply an inevitable continuation of this process. The Axis preparedness for change are no less significant than war itself. It is an act of war on the status quo. Each member of the resistance has been waiting for the prime opportunity to display the strength they obtained as this shifting power balance takes shape. And October 7th provided that opportunity. October 7th was a necessary step in dismantling the U.S. presence in the region. The decade and fall of the Zionist entity has forced the United States to reconsider this presence in both its nature and extent, and is therefore playing an essential role in changing the face of the region from one suffocating under the pressure of U.S. hegemony to one that is de-Americanized, self-sufficient, and free.
This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Palestine Declassified.
I'm Chris Williamson, and this is Palestine Declassified. We're the only weekly show focusing on investigating and exposing the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. After Elon Musk bought Twitter, now known as X, he promised to restore free speech to the platform. But the multi-billionaire is being squeezed by the Zionist lobby to force him to reimpose censorship on commentary about Palestine. The previous incumbents caved in to an intense campaign by Zionist extremists and imposed shadow bans on this show, Professor David Miller, and myself. But after Musk took over, the bans were lifted on us and on numerous other accounts too. But the billion-dollar question now is, will he succumb to the pressure? Latif Abu Chakra has this report about Musk's recent visit to the settler colony and the Zionist tactics being deployed against him.
The social media platform X has provided a vital lifeline to journalists debunking Israel's disinformation around its genocidal war on Gaza. Several lies that Israeli occupation forces pushed out were immediately discredited by investigative journalists on the site. For that reason, Elon Musk is simultaneously a key ally and target of the Zionist regime. Musk has been mobilized against by key Zionist lobby groups like the Anti-Defamation League and the Center for Countering Digital Hate. And it is likely that his visit was an opportunity for the Zionist regime to apply more pressure on him to censor the social media platform. During the short pause in Israel's bombing of Gaza, the billionaire owner of the platform X, Elon Musk, traveled to meet with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu for an indoctrination session. While in occupied Palestine, he was taken on a guided tour of the Gaza settlement envelope by Netanyahu. A solemn picture was taken with Musk looking down at a baby cot, supposedly littered with bullets from the Palestinian resistance. However, it was revealed that those bullets matched those coming from Israeli tanks rather than Palestinian fighters. And as the war of disinformation continues, large U.S. corporations like Walt Disney, Warner Brothers, and Comcast suspended their ads on X in protest against his alleged anti-Semitism. This has, of course, been lobbied for by Israel's spy agency, the Anti-Defamation League, for some time. The U.S. government has even issued a statement condemning Musk for the abhorrent promotion of anti-Semitic and racist hate. In October, when Israel cut all electronic communications in Gaza, Musk offered to provide his Starlinks to internationally recognized aid organizations in the Strip. This infuriated the Israelis, who vetoed the idea immediately. While on his trip to the settler entity, Musk commented to Israeli President Isaac Herzog that he supported the idea of re-education camps in Gaza to prevent another generation of resistance. He also commented that he would help establish economic prosperity in the area. With the constant stream of contradictory messages, the battle for the soul of Elon Musk continues.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and a former professor at Bristol University, and is now a non-resident senior research fellow at the Center for Islam and Global Affairs at Istanbul Zeyim University. He's also a co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch, and he's a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. And I'm delighted to welcome Ghadi Francis as our guest today. Ghadi is a Lebanese war correspondent who's worked for Al Mayadeen, Al Jazeera and others, and over the years she's reported directly from conflict zones in Syria, Iraq and Yemen. Welcome to the show. David, let me start with you. What do you think went on with Elon Musk in the Zionist entity then? Interesting trip, wasn't it?
Well, very curious, wasn't it? I mean, we saw that footage, didn't we, of him with Netanyahu with his flak jacket on,
yes,
strolling around the kibbutz, looking perplexed and interested. And we saw all sorts of statements about how awful it was that the Israelis were facing what they were, and how From the River to the Sea was an anti-Semitic call for genocide and wouldn't be allowed henceforth on Twitter or X. So we saw, essentially, in that trip, we saw him becoming an obvious and stated Zionist. Now, of course, that's not quite the full story, but that's what we saw there. We saw him looking at that crib. Remember the crib with the bullets in it, which it transpired were not, in fact, resistance bullets, IDF or IOF bullets. So we saw a performance there, which looked very worrying for those who had believed his stories about freedom of expression.
Yeah. I mean, Ghadi, What's the opinion of the resistance access in the Middle East towards Musk, do you think?
Well, I don't know if I can really say the resistance access, because it's quite big, and like there's a spectrum of ideologies in the resistance access. And I'd say it is also the same when it comes to Elon Musk visit. Some people really paid attention to that, and others found it irrelevant. As in, we've never expected more out of such personalities. No. For people in the Middle East, for people in the resistance of access, a big tech personality that has always been aligned with the U.S. foreign policy and that does these kinds of businesses for them, we don't expect him to come and say free Palestine. I think for me personally, nothing was surprising.
No.
What he did wasn't surprising. And also there were these resurfacing anti-Semitic comments that he had done. And we have seen that in history previously, whether it's scientists or businessmen or actually Microsoft and other tech companies. When they do such things, they have to whitewash what they did, and they end up being first front line of the Zionist propaganda just to make up for what they had done previously. Mm. So when it comes to the axis of resistance, they never took Elon Musk as an ally. So I don't think the expectation was really more than that.
No, indeed. Well, David, I mean, how exactly then did the Anti-Defamation League and the Center for Countering Digital Hate actually lobby Elon Musk then?
Well, they did a number of different reports and accusations about him being anti-Semitic, but of course also they did a specific report on this program, if
indeed
you recall,
they did.
Done by the Center for Countering Digital Hate, an organization created in this country but also having a DC office, which was also co-published by the ADL. Of course, that suggested that we were a vehicle for Iranian state propaganda, yeah, and that we casually gave out anti-Semitic comments week after week, entirely false, of course, and a report based on ridiculous research that hasn't even got names attached to it, so you can't tell who wrote it. So that was the way in which they did it, and of course, it's interesting that as you said at the beginning of the programme, that when he took over, our Twitter accounts, the Twitter account for the show, were labelled as Iran state-affiliated media, we were shadow banned, and all that came away, fell away, and really what you've seen with pro-Palestine accounts on Twitter in the last month or so is a massive increase in followers and reach, and that doesn't appear to be, there's some signs that there's a kind of rowing back on the algorithm in relation to that, and really in relation to particular accounts, but it doesn't in general appear to be the case. On the idea that somehow that Musk would outlaw From the River to the Sea as a hashtag, well, I mean, it only massively increased after he said that, and I don't believe that anybody has been banned, so far as I'm aware, for using the hashtag. I certainly haven't been put into control measures for it. So it looks like that there's a real problem there for them, is that because overwhelmingly social media users on Facebook, on X, on Instagram, on TikTok are pro-Palestine, and there's not much they can do about that.
Mm. Gandhi, I mean, how do you think Elon Musk's management of Twitter, or X as it's now known, compares to other platforms like Instagram, for example?
Well, if you want to compare to Meta, to Instagram and to Facebook, he'd look like the angel. Because the prohibitions...
It's a low bar, though, isn't it?
Really, because we've been working our words around the shadow bans on Instagram and melons and all kind of vegetables just to convey the message we want to say. It has also become something global. So if we want to compare that to X, formerly known as Twitter, well, it's still, we can still articulate our thoughts without being slaughtered virtually like it's done on Instagram and Meta. But still, it's not really safe out there. And we see it very, it's like walking on eggshells when you really want to say, to speak your mind, and you're not being racist or it's not really hate or violence. When you want to articulate a thought of resistance, you are walking on eggshells, but you get all these trolls that are basically literally saying that you should be killed and that babies should be killed, and they're always there, and they don't get the same kind of security police. No. Well, this is up so far. This is what I've been seeing. It is not. There's no justice in regulating how we are being attacked, but there is always like a police watching what our words are. Mm. Well, but still, it's not really as secure as it once was, because there's this one person who has been sitting next to Benjamin Netanyahu, and this is the person in charge. So we don't know when overnight, but well, for example, I have a verified account. I don't know when overnight it wouldn't be verified anymore, because I've been saying Free Palestine ever since I was born. No, you know, indeed, so I'm not allowed to exist on X, probably.
I mean, he's certainly a sort of an idiosyncratic sort of character, isn't he, Elon Musk? And, I mean, and some of the positions he's taken, David, do sort of indicate a degree of independence, don't they, do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I would take two examples. One is, of course, the example of Ukraine, where he started to say to the US government that they would have to start paying for Starlink. Mm. And then he also refused to allow them to have Starlink. On a particular moment when they were trying to attack the Crimea. So that the Pentagon didn't like that very much. The Americans didn't like that very much. So that was an indication of that he can't, that, you know, he was saying, well, we can't be used for aggressive purposes. And in a way, that's what he's saying on Gaza too, where he's talking about developing. Yes, he talked about re-education camps, of course, the ridiculousness that it was. But he also talked about regeneration, investing in Gaza. And of course, that means profits for him. But it's not quite as straightforward as a simple genocidal Zionist approach. I mean, I would also say that, you know, that when he came back from visiting the settler colony, he did that famous interview where he said about advertisers, they can go F themselves.
Yes, right? Indeed.
I mean, pretty extraordinary. Now, the people he's talking to there is the ADL and the Centre for Countering Digital Hate, who have been the ones who've been behind the advertiser boycott. Mm. So on the one hand, he's saying to Netanyahu, oh, well, I'm fully behind the Zionists and you shouldn't be calling for the end of Israel. On the other hand, he's saying to the ADL, absolutely not, I'm having nothing to do with you. So that's a real indication that there's something contradictory in his personality or his way of doing this, and it's partly, I guess, his kind of libertarian ideas about freedom and that kind of thing, which is behind that. But it's a deeply contradictory approach, isn't it? But some elements of it are quite interesting.
Yeah, no, indeed. Well, we're just going to pause the discussion there for a moment, because I'd like to get both of your thoughts after this about Elon Musk's involvement with Israeli companies and, indeed, regime change operations.
The history of Elon Musk's tumultuous love affair with Israel has had some fascinating twists and turns. Musk borrowed $1 billion to buy Twitter from Larry Ellison, one of the biggest known financiers of the Israeli military. Because of their close relationship, Ellison extended an offer to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to become a director of his software business, Oracle, and even was due to be a witness for Netanyahu at his delayed corruption trial. Additionally, Authentix, an Israeli company founded by former Israeli intelligence officials, is working with Musk on his X platform. The new ID verification process, which asks users to provide legitimate ID documents and selfies, is administered by Authentix. It is a project of the Dutch security company, ICTS International, which was established by former Shin Bet operatives. Musk and his Starlink satellites were also implicated in the failed regime change campaign against Iran. When U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken mentioned the necessity of the U.S. government supporting Iranian protesters, Musk responded immediately with the words, "activating Starlink." Musk then publicly boasted about donating, quote, 100 active Starlinks in Iran, end quote, to help regime change rioters communicate. Elon Musk is also working closely with Israel to combat the resistance axis in the region. Musk's company, SpaceX, launched spy satellites for ImageSat International, an Israeli intelligence firm, to identify targets for airstrikes in Syria. The company's CEO, Noam Sigal, is an Israeli Air Force reservist. ImageSat International has been a critical component in Israel's 1,000 attacks on Syria in the past years. Both ImageSat International and the Israeli Embassy in the United States officially thanked Elon Musk for the launch of their spy satellite above Syria on his X platform. Will his next service to Israel be the censoring of pro-Palestinian voices on the platform? Time will tell.
David, so Image International, just say a bit about its role then. I mean, it's mentioned in the video there, in the Israelis' bombing campaign in Syria.
So it's the tech which allows them, in part, the intelligence and the operational ability to carry out these attacks, 1,000 attacks roughly over the last few years, attacks which have gone almost entirely unanswered, unremarked in the Western media. There's not been the capacity in the Syrian government or at least not the ability to counteract those. Not been any pushback really on that. And what we see there is this is part of a wider Zionist intervention in Syria. It's been in the Times of Israel just the other day that the outgoing occupation forces chief has admitted supplying weapons to, I think, 12 separate anti-government, pro-NATO proxy forces in the Syrian conflict. And, of course, we already knew from the famous Priti Patel visit to the Golan Heights, to the IDF field hospital, as it was called, IOF field hospital, that they were patching up Nusra fighters and other anti-Assad fighters and sending them back to the conflict. So we know that this has been a full-scale involvement of the Zionists, along with the West and indeed with the Saudis and, of course, Qatar in that conflict. So that's an indication, really, of his role in regime change operations, just like the one that he's been involved in relation to Iran.
Mm. I mean, Gadi, I mean, did you think the information contained in these reports would change people's opinions in any way at all?
Well, unlike what would be expected, I don't think it would. Because if you're looking at, I think we had an example when Elon Musk came and did this tour with Benjamin Netanyahu. And I think the approach or the general view of Elon Musk is like a businessman selling his product.
Yeah.
So if his product is being used to kill us, our problem isn't with him, it's with the buyer. I don't know if I'm articulating it accurately, because we've seen, if they want to really be angry, the people in the region, angry at Elon Musk, they have to be angry at some states, some Arab states that are providing oil, gas, fuel and money and planes for the killers as well. So basically it's like they're buying his product, but they will not really hold him accountable. I don't think so.
Right. Well, David, I mean, just moving on then, I mean, what do you know about this character Larry Ellison? Because he's pretty close, isn't he, to both Netanyahu and to Elon Musk?
Yes, and we've talked about Ellison before, and his company,
on the show,
Oracle, which I'll mention again in a minute. But of course, I mean, it's worth remarking, isn't it, on the fact that he just had to hand $1 billion lying about that he could offer to Musk, lend to him so he could buy Twitter and turn it into X. And Ellison is, as the film shows, extremely close to Netanyahu, offered him a place on the board. And Oracle, as a tech firm, one of the biggest tech firms, has been involved in multi-million dollar and pound contracts, for example, in the UK with the Ministry of Defence. So much of the cloud computing support for the Ministry of Defence in the UK is provided by Oracle, a company which has, through Ellison and through the senior staff at Oracle, direct links to Israeli intelligence. So we have a real issue here, again, with those kinds of links and with his mate being Larry Ellison, but at the same time, of course, Musk remains a contradictory character, even in the face of those kinds of links.
But Gadi, I mean, do you think then that Israel's found it easier or more difficult to deal with Musk than they did with the previous incumbents who controlled the Twitter platform?
Well, I'd say absolutely easier. Really? Musk is absolutely easier.
Right.
There's one person to deal with, and you know where to twist their arm.
Indeed.
And we obviously saw that in manifestation, like during the past 2 weeks. So I think Israel found Musk a way easier person to handle.
And David, I mean, what's the significance of Musk using Authentix, if I'm pronounced that correctly, for user verification? And why is that a problem?
Well, it means that you and I and Gary here, whenever we upload our data to become verified, have the blue tick.
But then again, aren't we giving that data with our phones and smartphones one way or the other to the same systems? That's my question to myself. Mm. WhatsApp.
We are, that's right.
Face identity. Super powerful tech companies are way smarter than that. I think they have all my information already. Mm.
They do. The problem with them having it, of course, is the links that there are between those companies and Israeli intelligence. So,
us, in Lebanon, everything gets to the Israelis.
That's right.
Yeah.
The issue, it seems to me, is that this is not on the radar of the Western public. People don't know about this. And what we need to do is to push back against this in Lebanon, in the UK, in the US, and elsewhere, wherever it's happening, because this is a perennial problem which we have to deal with in addition to the more obvious manifestations.
It's very unfortunate that they have normalized it for us.
Yeah.
Mm. You know, it has been normalized in our brains that we are basically shared. All our data is shared one way or the other with the Israelis, whether it's on WhatsApp.
But through shows like ours, we can raise people's awareness, a consciousness of, about the downside. No, indeed. Well, we need to obviously be pushing back against that. But God, let me just move back and on a little bit and just ask you, whether you think that the current wars will become a regional conflagration, or indeed do you think it already is?
Of course. Thank you for the added part of the question. Well, this war in the region is 75 years old.
Yes.
Whether they say it is there or not, I haven't witnessed any day in my life where there hasn't been something done to my people. In Syria, in Lebanon, in Palestine, in Iraq, in Yemen. So when is it war and when is it peace? People are dying every day. Aren't they precious to their parents, to their futures? Don't they have aspirations? So no, we have been in war because there is an apartheid ethno-state armed with billion-dollar-funded weaponry, and it is killing and trying to kill each and every person from the indigenous peoples that are here. So the war is regional because even before October 7, there wasn't any week without tit-for-tat attacks between the Axis of Resistance and the Israelis, whether it's in the sea or in Syria or in Iraq, Iraqi-Syrian borders, or Lebanon. I mean, in Lebanon, maybe it's semi-daily that we have Israeli planes in our... I hear them almost daily. And we wonder when will they, attack us, because they openly say they want to. Indeed. They openly say next is Beirut after Gaza. So the war... We have been living it, but the war hasn't been globally, outrageously displayed. We haven't been living a televised genocide, before. So when we say, is it going to spill to the region? I say the United States of America is involved in this war. It is already global, sir.
Yeah, absolutely.
It is already global.
Yeah. I mean, and the billion-dollar question that I mentioned at the beginning of the show is, will Elon Musk then... succumb to that pressure? I mean, whether perhaps get both of your thoughts on that. What do you think, Gadi?
I think Elon Musk is a businessman.
Yeah.
And he's going to put his mouth where the money is.
Hmm.
I know tech is really involved in this new era in the warfare. I know AI is being used to kill us and to kill our children. Hmm. And thank you for exposing that and working on that. But in the end of the day, I would regard him, in the worst case scenario, just like the big moguls that sell weapons or sell pharma or these decision makers. It's a blend of these. I wouldn't take Elon Musk out of that herd of people who are making money out of war.
Yeah. What do you think to the billion-dollar question?
I think that's right. I think the only curious thing about Elon Musk is that he has these kind of weird ideas about freedom of speech, which do seem to make a difference to how he runs the company, in contrast with how Twitter was before, where they were simply stuffed with Zionists at the top of the company, where they asked only Zionists to judge who should be on it and who shouldn't. Yeah. So that's the one distinction I would make.
Sure. Well... unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there because that's it for another show as we're out of time again. I'd like to thank our guest, Gadi Francis, and, of course, our resident expert, Professor David Miller. Palestine Declassified will be back next week with more forensic investigations and analysis. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
In the Limelight.
With few hospitals functioning in Gaza, because the Zionist regime has bombed virtually all of them, there is desperate shortage of medicines and even electricity. The case of children with smashed limbs is extremely painful. There is no anesthesia in the few hospitals that are still functioning. Children's limbs have to be amputated without anesthesia. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Crescent International Road, more than 21,000 civilians have been killed in Gaza by the Zionist regime war criminals since October 7th. They can be considered lucky. After all, their suffering is over, even if they have left behind grieving relatives. Among the dead are more than 8,000 children. And there are at least 7,000 Palestinians, many of them women and children, buried under the rubble of collapsed buildings. There is no heavy equipment to lift the huge concrete slabs to find out if they are still alive. There is another aspect of their suffering that needs to be told.